A small gang of black men were clearing the collar area of the reef, and Ralph recognized the tallest of them. "Butso!" he cried, and the Induna straightened up and rested on his pick-handle. "Henshaw," he greeted Ralph gravely, "have you come to watch the real men at work?" Batso's flat, hard muscle shone like wet anthracite, and running sweat had left snaking trails down it. "Real men?" Ralph asked. "You promised me 200, and you have brought me 20.
"The others are waiting," Batso promised. "But they will not come if they cannot bring their women with them. One bright eye wants the women to stay in the villages."
"They can bring their women as many as they wish. I will speak to one bright eye. Go to them. Choose the strongest and the best. Bring me your old comrades from the Mole's Impi, and tell them I will pay them well and feed them better. And they can bring their women and breed strong sons to work my mines."
"I will leave in the morning," Batso decided, "and be back before the moon shows its horns again."
When the two white men moved on down the survey line, Batso watched them for a while, his face expressionless, and his eyes inscrutable. Then he looked at his gang and nodded. They spat on their palms, hefted their pickaxes, and Batso sung out the opening chorus of the work chant.
"Abu nyonyo buginye entudla!"
"The little black ants can eat up the giraffe." Batso had composed the line beside the corpse of a giraffe struck down by the rinderpest, and untouched by all the gorged scavengers of the felt, except a colony of the black safari ants, which had cleaned the cadaver down to the bone. The significance of it had stayed with Batso. How, by persistence, even the greatest are overcome, and the seemingly innocent line of gibberish now insidiously preparing the minds of the Amadoda, who laboured under him. At the invocation, they swung their picks on high, standing shoulder to shoulder, the crescent-headed tools silhouetted against the flat blue of the sky.
"Guga inzimba,"
they replied in soaring chorus. "Sala rinziyo." "Though our bodies are worn out, our hearts are constant." And then together, the humming gee, as they pickheads hissed downwards in unison, and with a crash buried themselves in the iron earth. Each man levered his pickhead free, took one step forward and braced himself as Batso sang,
"The little black ants can eat up the giraffe."
And again the act was repeated, and again, and 100 times more, while the sweat was flung from their bodies and the red dust flew. Batso loped along at a deceptively easy gait that never varied, though the hills were steep and the valleys abrupt. His spirits were joyous, and he had not truly realized how much the labors of the last weeks had galled until he was released from them. Once, long ago, he had worked with pick and shovel in the yellow diamond pit at Kimberley. Henshaw had been his companion then, and the two of them had made a game of the brutal, endless labor. It had built their muscles and made them strong, but had caged and cramped their spirits until neither of them could suffer it longer, and they had escaped together. Since those days, Batso had known the savage joy and the divine madness of that terrible moment that the Matabili call the closing in. He had stood against the king's enemies and killed in the sunlight with his regimental plumes flying. He had won honours and the respect of his peers. He had sat on the king's council with the Induna's head ring on his brow, and he had come to the brink of the Black River and briefly looked beyond it into the forbidden land that men call death. And now he had learned a new truth. It was more painful for a man to go backwards than it is for him to go forward. The drudgery of menial labour rankled the more now for the glories that had preceded it. The path dropped away towards the river and disappeared into the dense dark green vegetation like a serpent into its hole. Batso followed it down and stooped into the gloomy tunnel and then froze. Instinctively, his right hand reached for the non-existent assegai on its leather thong under the grip of the long shield that also was not there. So hard do old habits die. The shield had long ago been burned on the bonfires with 10,000 other shields, and the steel snapped in half on the anvils of the BSA Company blacksmiths. Then he saw this was no enemy that came towards him down the narrow tunnel of riverine bush, and his heart bounded almost painfully against his ribs.
"I see you, Lord," Tanasi greeted him softly.
She was slim and upright, as the young girl he had captured at the stronghold of Pemba the wizard, the same long, graceful legs and clinched-in waist, the same heron's neck like the stem of a lovely black lily.
"Why are you so far from the village?" he demanded,
as she knelt dutifully before him and clapped her hand softly at the level of her waist.
"I saw you under the road, Batso, son of Gandang."
And he opened his mouth to question her further, for he had come swiftly. Then he changed his mind and felt the little superstitious prickle of insect feet along the nape of his neck. Sometimes, still, there were things about this woman that disquieted him, for she had not been stripped of all her occult powers in the cave of the Amlimo.
"I see you, Lord," Tanasi repeated, "and my body calls to yours the way a hungry infant, fresh roused from sleep, frets for the breast."
He lifted her up and held her face between his hands to examine it, as though he had picked a rare and beautiful flower in the forest. It had taken much to accustom himself to the way she spoke of their secret bodily desires. He had been taught that it was unseemly for a Matabele wife to show pleasure in the act of generation, and to speak of it the way a man does. Instead, she should be merely a pliant and unprotesting vessel for her husband's seed, ready whenever he was, and unobtrusive and self-effacing when he was not. Tanasi was none of these things. At first she had shocked and horrified him with some of the things she had learned in her apprenticeship for the dark mysteries. However, shock had turned to fascination as she had unfolded each skill before him. She had potions and perfumes that could arouse a man even when he was exhausted and wounded from the battlefield. She had tricks of voice and eyes that bit like an arrowhead. Her fingers could find unerringly the spots beneath his skin, at places on his body of which even he was unaware, upon which she played like the keys of a marimba, making him more man than he had ever dreamed was possible. Her own body she could use more skillfully than he could wield his shield and long bright steel and deal as telling blows. She could make each separate muscle of her body move and tighten in complete freedom from the muscles around it. At will she could bring him to precipitous rushing release, or keep him hovering high as a black-shouldered kite when it hunts on sharply stabbing pinions. "We have been too long apart," she whispered, with that combination of voice and slant of wide Egyptian eyes that tripped his breath and made his heart race. "I came to meet you alone, so we could be free for a while of your son's clamorous adoration and the eyes of the villagers." And she led him off the track, and unclasped her leather cloak to spread it on the soft bed of fallen leaves. Long after the storm had passed, and the aching tension had left his body, when his breathing was deep and even again, and his eyelids drooped with the deeply contented lassitude that follows the act of love, she raised herself on her elbow above him, and with a kind of reverential wonder, traced out the planes of his face with the tip of one finger, and then said softly, "Bayeti." It was the greeting that is made only to a king, and he stirred uncomfortably, and his eyes opened wide. He looked at her, and knew that expression. Their loving had not softened her, and made her sleepy, as it had done to him. That royal greeting had not been a jest.
"Bayeti," she said again. "The sound of it troubles you, my fine sharp-bladed axe. But why should it do so?"
Suddenly Batso felt the insects of fear and superstition crawling on his skin again, and he was angry and afraid.
"Do not talk like this, woman. Do not offend the spirits with your silly girlish prattlings."
She smiled, but it was a cruel cat-like smile, and she repeated, "Oh, Batso, the bravest and the strongest, why do you then start so at my girlish words?
You, in whose veins run the purest blood of Zanzi, son of Gandang, the son of Mzilikazi, Do you dream perchance of the little redwood spear that Lobengula carried in his hand, son of Juba, whose great-grandfather was mighty Diniswayo, who was nobler even than his protege Shaka, who became king of Zulu? Do you not feel the royal blood coursing in your veins? Does it make you itch for things you dare not even speak aloud? You are mad, woman. The Mopani bees have entered your head and driven you mad. But Tanasi smiled, still with her lips close to his ear, and she touched his eyelids with her soft pink fingertip. Do you not hear the widows of Shangani and Bembezi crying aloud, "Our father Lobengula is gone! We are orphans with no one to protect us!" Do you not see the men of Matabili land with empty hands entreat the spirits, "Give us a king!" they cry. "We must have a king!" "Babian," whispered Batso. "Somabula and Gandang, they are Lobengula's brothers. They are old men, and the stone has fallen out of their bellies. The fire has gone out in their eyes."
"Tanasi, do not speak so."
"Batso, my husband, my king, do you not see to whom the eyes of all the Indunas turn when the nation is in council?"
"Madness," Batso shook his head.
"Do you not know whose word they wait upon now? Do you not see how even Babian and Somabula listen when Batso speaks?"
She laid the palm of her hand over his mouth to still his protests, and then in one swift movement she had mounted and straddled him again, and miraculously he was ready, and more than ready for her, and she cried out fiercely, "Bayeti, son of kings! Bayeti, father of kings! Whose seed will rule when the white men have been swallowed again by the ocean which spewed them up!" And with a shuddering cry he felt as though she had drawn the very life-force from his guts, and left in its place a dreadful, haunting longing, a fire in his blood that would not be assuaged until he held in his hand the little redwood spear that was the symbol of the Nguni monarch. They went side by side, hand in hand, which was a curious thing, for a Matabili wife always walks behind her husband, with the roll of the sleeping mat balanced upon her head. But they were like children caught up in a kind of delirious dream, and when they reached the crest of the pass, Batso took her in his arms and held her to his breast, in an embrace that he had never used before. "If I am the axe, then you are the cutting edge, for you are part of me, but the sharpest part. Together, Lord, we will hack through anything that stands in our way," she answered fiercely. And then she pulled out from the circle of his arms and lifted the flap of the beaded pouch upon her belt. "I have a gift to make your brave heart braver and your will as hard as your steel." She took something soft and grey and fluffy from her pouch and stood before him on tiptoe, reaching high with both arms to bind the strip of fur around his forehead. "Wear this moleskin for the glory that was and that shall be again in Duna of the moles who burrowed under a hill. One day soon we will change it for a headband of spotted gold leopard skin with royal blue heron feathers set upon it." She took his hand, and they started down from the hilltop. But they did not reach the grassy plain before Batso stopped again and inclined his head to listen. There was a faint popping sound on the small dry breeze, like the bubbles bursting in a pot of boiling porridge. "Guns," he said. "Still far away, but many of them." "It is so, Lord," Tanasi replied. "Since you left, the guns of one bright eyes Kanka have been busy as the tongues of the old women at a beer drink.